That's what I was thinking of.
That's what we're thinking about, right, we're looking at it.
Can I mention one other thing that, now, I noticed in Criminal Law Reporter, several months ago, there was an article with respect to a speech made by Senator McClellan with respect to the Omnibus Crime Control Bill. He noted at that time that there were about six states that had enacted legislation to conform. So, now there may be some others since then. So not all of the states have enacted legislation, but it's certainly my opinion that we've got to conform to this if it's going to be legal. Otherwise, we'd be in violation of the federal law.
If the federal statute could be used in Oregon, we have to conform it, isn't that the point?
Well, it means if we're going to authorize
anything, it's got to be in conformity with federal.
Wiretapping, it has to conform to the requirements of this crime control.
We couldn't have something less, in other words, in the federal law applying to Oregon.
So I think that, I assume that the commission wants to provide for this type of situation.
Well, I think we should.
I don't quite understand why, maybe I'm thick-headed, but I don't quite understand why we couldn't have something less if we wanted.
Something less in the way of protection.
Well, for one thing, it provides it's a federal crime if you intercept communications except as provided by this chapter.
How do you do it if you do it over the Pacific Northwest Bell telephone? That's a big commerce.
Yeah.
Pick up the receiver, isn't it? Call across town.
Yeah.
Call across town.
No, but no, there's anything states can affect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I get it.
Except as otherwise specifically provided in this chapter, any person who does, and then they list a whole slew of different acts, intercepting or any wire or oral communication, willfully uses, endeavors to use, or procures any other person to use any electronic, mechanical, or other device to accept any oral communication. And they go on, willfully discloses or endeavors to disclose the contents of any wire or oral communication, et cetera, et cetera. So we fine not more than $10,000, or prison not more than 5 years, or both.
Well, I think what I was asking is, I don't see what would keep us from making this more strict, that is, from making it a crime.
Oh, no. Oh, sure, I would agree with that. You can go beyond the requirements. Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, that's what
you could certainly do that. Yeah,
I don't know what I said, but that's what was going through my head.
Sure, we could certainly do that and make it stricter if you wanted to do that.
In fact, Illinois has done that.
Mm-hmm.
They have outlawed all interception communications with no warrant procedure.
Well, why don't you, you're going to have to wrestle with the draft and that. You've got the policy, the direction, and why don't we go on and see if we can't get these other five sections
if we can. Go ahead. Section 3.
This possession of an eavesdropping device. A person commits a crime with possession of an eavesdropping device if he possesses an eavesdropping device with the intent that it be unlawfully used by himself or another for eavesdropping.
This
should seem to
take care of
it.
Three would take care of that.
Your reference to carrying a dangerous weapon or concealing or so on and so forth is merely examples.
Examples of legislation prohibiting possession of certain instruments of crime.
Is there any argument about that one?
No.
I live with it.
Like, does possession mean in a store ready for sale?
No.
No, possession is defined under your control.
It doesn't prohibit monkey wards from selling parabolic microphones to neighbor kids.
No,
right.
It doesn't.
No, the kid keeps it for illegal purposes, the only purpose he'd have it for. It prohibits him from having it.
What's possession defined, though?
Yeah, but you've got to prove that it's not
a general definition.
You've got to show intent.
Catch it with
yeah.
Call roll.
Senator Briggs?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
I stood by.
Ross?
Aye.
Jernstead?
Aye.
O'Dell?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spalding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I wonder if I might throw out to the body, is it possible to license the possession of parabolic and listening devices and so on?
Well, you see, this thing provides that if it's possessed with an intention...
To use it illegally.
To use, with the intent that it be unlawfully used by himself or another person. So I don't see how a license in this situation where it's confined to this... I don't think it'd do any good, Don.
Well, you'd give them a license, but you wouldn't give a 15-year-old kid a license.
You can't require them to have a license.
But if that 15-year-old kid possesses it with no intent that it be used unlawfully by himself or another for ease of...
You've got to prove intent.
Hmm?
When that 15-year-old kid walks into Monkey Ward's and Monkey Ward's does the irresponsible act of selling him that device, there's no violation of law.
No.
You want to make it a strict liability crime.
I don't want them to sell that thing in the first place.
You don't want to make it unlawful for Monkey Ward or anybody else to sell those things without the purchaser having a license or something?
Yeah.
What about the 15-year-old kid who likes to record bird calls?
Tape recorder.
Can't have him get a license.
Well, that's the problem in this area. There are just too many...
Who's going to decide? How's the licensing authority going to decide whether he really wants to recall bird calls?
And yet, it's spelling out in the statute. What is the lawful purpose?
The legitimate uses of these devices far exceeds the illegitimate use of them.
Oh, yeah. Most everybody's got a tape recorder.
Yeah, I think it's enough if the possession here is by someone who intends to use it unlawfully.
I'll go for that if the commission will go for licensing all guns in the state.
If you can get a second on anything, you want to make it?
There's a motion and a second. Do you want to any further discussion? License for all guns purchased and owned. Renewable annually.
You sold out in Bend, huh, Bob?
I've been for a gun license for a long time.
You've been for it?
Well, let's go to section 4.
15 years.
No, we may have the votes to pass that.
It's already passed. Oh, you mean the gun license?
Firearms.
Oh, we haven't come to that yet.
I know.
Section 4, Roger.
Very short statute. Forfeiture of eavesdropping devices. An eavesdropping device installed or used in violation of this article shall be forfeited to the state.
Now, the only question I have, and we didn't discuss it in the subcommittee, is there a general statute which provides for a disposition of forfeited material by the state?
There's one in the liquor.
The sheriff. Sheriff has authority to dispose of certain things, and the state has authority to dispose of...
Game Commission disposes of the beaver hides, and the sheriff disposes of the guns and the bicycles.
So we dispose of this, the DA gets it. Who does he give it to? Does he give it to the sheriff? Does he have to have...
A car seized and a narcotic or liquor, those have got to be sold by the sheriff.
That's right. What about... What would this, who would this be sold by?
The same thing. That's the way that the card reads to the state.
And there's a... All right.
There's a statute providing for the sheriff to sell. In fact, they sell them. They have to sell them periodically.
A lot of them are
Yes.
There's no real procedure set up on forwarding. It just says that they're forwarding. You have to get a court order before you do it. I would assume... So?
Roger?
Yes.
How about procedure?
We don't have a procedure here. In fact, the original draft, we gave it to the state police. But the only thing we can do is refer to some other part of the regulatory code, for example, the liquor narcotics. For example, the liquor code has a rather long, drawn-out procedure for disposing of automobiles. Because they're concerned with pre-existing liens, other interests in the automobile, claims may be made upon it. And they provide for your public auction and sale and then disposition of the money.
Why would it satisfy you if we added to this that the court will so order and direct the method of disposition? That would be the third or fourth way we had.
Why don't we just do it to one of the existing statutes incorporated for procedure? One of the systems. I don't care which.
No,
on weapons, you've got a procedure provided for the destruction of concealed weapons. They can't be sold, but other weapons can. They're surrendered to the magistrate before whom the person is taken, except that in any city, county, town, or other municipal corporation. The weapon shall be surrendered to the head of the police force or police department. And the officers then are required to account for them, and they destroy them.
They don't.
No. They're supposed to.
They give the retired army general.
Yeah.
That's right.
We demonstration is about by the Boy Scouts.
Well, why don't you work on this and incorporate into it the procedure for disposal?
Well, maybe related to some other statute. For the forfeiture. What if you don't?
That's
have
what I mean for forfeiture.
You find a thing set up in some room, the buggy device, but you don't have enough evidence to charge anybody with the buggy. You've got the device.
Well, in that case, you simply return it.
Replace it and let it sit there.
Sure.
Until you can prove that the guy's guilty.
Yeah.
Oh, if you find one being obviously used for criminal activity, but you cannot prove who was in control of it, you can still seize the device.
Well, does this mean that a person has to be convicted?
No.
Of the crime?
I thought so, and you know, Ron convinced me just now. Anyway.
No.
Well, I would say that it could be forfeited, and that's what I'm wondering about a procedure. Do you apply to the court for an order forfeiting it to the state? Do you just automatically it's forfeited? Does the police officer himself decide whether it's
proceeding in rem?
I don't know. I don't think the police officers, they have too many of these gadgets already that they pick up this way. I think there should be an order of the court of some sort. The
police officer just use it.
Yeah. Infallible.
Now, on page 23, the Michigan section says that they shall be turned, shall by court order be turned over to the Department of State Police for whatever disposition its director
may order.
Director may order. Well, so they leave it up to the superintendent of state police.
You kind of hate to break up the 200 tape recorders.
Well, why don't you look into some of the other statutes and
that
add
reasonable
here?
Right there. Yeah, well, yeah, of course, this didn't provide for the destruction of them. This was just a forfeiture.
Yeah.
And the superintendent state police can decide whether it be destroyed or not be destroyed.
No, I don't think you'd want to require a destruction of these things.
I don't necessarily mean a destruction. Or an order ordering forfeiture and determining the disposition.
But wouldn't it be all right, like Michigan has, to leave it up to the superintendent of Oregon State Police?
Yeah. I think so. That'd be fine.
Forfeited by court order and then turned over to the superintendent of police for whatever use he wants.
You could just put a comma there after state.
Yeah.
And then add that, and shall by court order be turned over to the superintendent of the Oregon State Police. Whatever disposition he may order.
Yeah.
What provision do you make?
Who'll apply for that order?
Holder is for
district
the,
attorney?
Legal owner of the vehicle.
Yeah. Everybody in contact. Well, they can have
And you test tie down by the time you do this, it's not
regardless of the forfeiture.
What if a tape recorder bought up on time? Could he? It's forfeit. I suppose he could.
He's not a party.
Yeah. I think that language in Michigan is probably all right.
Okay, I move we approve section 4 as amended.
That's the Michigan language.
I second it.
Do you all understand the question?
Yep.
Call roll.
Cinderbury?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Ross?
I'm still concerned about this legal owners situation.
swallowing of Mr. Turi answered it.
Well, he answered the question by saying that, yes, I think you're right. I think it probably does exist. But we're talking about the director of the state police. Does he know it exists? Does he can say, oh, heck with it. Says forfeited, that means it's mine.
He'll find out after the first experience.
First time he does it wrong.
Well, what I'm thinking about, if I'm talking about a $100 machine or a $50 machine, how to put in it subject to the interest of any third person. Aye.
Jerry Stewart. O'Dell.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Section 5. Do you want to go into that before you completed those from 9 through 18?
Yeah. I think it's just, all this is, no matter what we do in 9 through 18, we want to make it a crime to tip off somebody, don't we?
Sure, I can put a number of people to read that, too.
Roger, would you tell us a little bit about Section 5?
Divulging an eavesdropping law, this is a restatement of this argument. A person commits a crime of divulging an eavesdropping warrant if having information concerning the existence or content of an eavesdropping warrant issued pursuant to Section 9 through 18 of this article, or concerning any facts or circumstances attending an application for such a warrant, he discloses that information to another person without specific legal authority.
I move we adopt it.
Nothing wrong with that.
Do we need the or?
Don't ask any questions.
All right. Discussion? Call the roll. Section 6.
Prince?
Section 5.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Ross.
Grimstead.
Aye.
O'Dell.
Aye.
Knight. Aye. Controlling. Aye. 5.
Aye.
Spaulding.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Section 6.
I'm going to
second. Discussion. Good little section. Short. Concise.
A lot of stuff.
Call the roll.
We have it at six.
Burns.
You know, having voted on the prevailing side, I want to give notice that
I may move
to reconsider section five because we don't have any element of culpability yet. We do in section six, and for that reason, I shall vote A.
Carson?
Able.
I don't have quite that explanation on this board.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Jernstead?
Aye.
O'Dell?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spaulding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Is there any objection on Section 5 to require that he must intentionally disclose the information so it'll conform with 6 and also have the element of culpability?
I think
that's a good idea.
Strict by
11.
You do?
Mm-hmm. It says without specific legal authority.
I do. Well, now, here's what will happen if we don't have this in there. It won't amount to strict liability unless we specifically say so because of our provisions on culpability. Now, we say, and if there's no culpability stated in the crime, nonetheless, it's still required, and so it would mean that the lowest form of culpability would be required under this, even if we don't require it specifically, and that would be criminally negligent disclosure.
Okay.
Which is all right.
Yeah, it's all right.
But if you want to make it strict liability, you'll have to say so specifically because of our general provisions on culpability. Because we give ourselves an out there if you want to have any strict liability statutes.
And negligently or otherwise.
You can't.
Whether without negligence.
Well, Bruce?
I have no motion to make. I am satisfied with the thing the way it was.
Well, let's leave it as it is with the notice having been given us that there may be a motion to reconsider. Section 6, call the roll. Section 7.
You didn't vote, though. I was waiting to hear your vote.
Aye.
Section
6.
I just wanted to hear it.
didn't want any conflicts of interest.
Right. Okay, Roger.
Just restates, Morgan Hall. Divulging illegally obtained information. The person commits the crime of divulging illegally obtained information.
Just pass that one.
Did that one.
We adopted that.
We adopted that one without explanation.
Section 7, defenses. It is a defense to a prosecution under this article that, one, the person charged was a public servant performing official duties in compliance with sections 9 through 18 of this article. In other words, he was a public servant within his scope of his authority and he had a warrant.
Yeah.
Or the person charged was an employee of a communication of common character who, while acting in the ordinary course of his employment, overheard the communication when transmitted to the facilities of his employer. This defense shall not apply to a prosecution of, under subsection 3 of section 8 of this article, which covers an employee officer of a telephone or telegraph company who divulges to another person the contents. Subsection 3, as a defense, communication intercepted or recorded consisted of a radio or television broadcast transmitted for the use of the general public, or was an emergency communication made in the normal course of operation by or to a state or local public agency dealing in emergency services.
Is our definition of public servant broad enough to cover something
broad,
that may not
the
actually
you ever
be
saw.
A police officer, but under the search warrant is acting direction of the police officer. We had some discussion on that. We were talking about public service, but I'm not sure what we ended up with.
It almost provides anyone using public streets.
Yeah. Any citizen of the state is a public servant for purposes of this draft.
I think that's included, though,
no, it's not
Frank.
Quite that broad.
Yeah.
You mean would a person acting under the direction of a police officer, for example, be exempted?
Yeah, he should be. And,
well,
but
yeah,
if we say
I
a public
be.
Servant, and I know that our definition of public servant theoretically went that far at one time, but whether it does now or not, I don't know. I'm trying to remember what you did.
You. You're part of it.
You
you're,
say
you're
we
part of the conspiracy, it. Frank. I'll draw a picture of you next.
Well, as number one, he would be included because while it only says public servant, it refers to the warrant procedures, and the warrant procedures provide these warrants can be executed by a law enforcement officer or someone operating under his.
Here we say public servant performing official duties.
Well, someone working under the direct supervision of a law enforcement officer
is a public servant.
Would be a public servant as far as the warrant was concerned.
That'll make a great argument to a jury in a criminal case.
Yeah. It's not a public servant as far as our definition is
concerned.
I think it's
an organization.
I think that would be specifically provided for.
Yeah, I agree. If you want
a public servant working under or a person in a free right use.
I'll move that.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Now,
on sub three, is there any way we could define emergency communication, or do we need to?
Well, as sure as we did, we would be unable to anticipate something that could be an emergency.
Yeah.
I think emergency can be defined from case to case.
Emergency.
That's what I said.
Do I hear it's a dandy. Your little motion on this, Jim, as amended?
I saw move.
You heard the motion. Second? Got it. Call the roll.
Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Grinstead?
Aye.
O'Dell?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Foley?
Yes.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Section 8, tampering with private communication.
All right, the only question I have, I don't know how this got through our subcommittee.
No, I've been looking at a couple of things that felt a little embarrassed.
So you're under sub 3, which is an exception in the previous one, so I'm working for a communications company, and I overhear something, and I tell my supervisor. Have I committed a crime? Have I?
Tell your supervisor.
While an employee or officer of a telephone company knowingly divulges to another person.
I would say yeah.
Well,
is that intended?
That's not intent.
Why would you tell us?
What's the intent in some cases?
Well, because if it might be something that...
that you think the supervisor ought to report to police.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the supervisor needs to have time to
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you ought to tell the supervisor anything other than reporting a crime.
Yeah, like so that's what I mean. I'm talking...
So that's what you're really getting
at. I'm talking about...
Whether the one who hears it should divulge it to the police.
Right.
Well,
here's a Pandora's box.
The only way you can get around that is by saying divulges to a person other than his own employer, the contents.
Well, I don't want the operator chit-chatting with the supervisor. That doesn't.
What we're really saying is an operator overhears a conversation that somebody says, I'm going to go down there now and shoot so-and-so. Should they be prohibited from calling the police and reporting them? That's what we're really talking about.
Well, in that case, who would ever charge her?
Well,
because of the fear of possibility.
Well, aren't there some people who are authorized, some people who have the right to know of communication? Police one, for example.
What is your ICC regs that prohibit this?
FCC?
FCC.
FCC has got some pretty strict rules in this.
Don't we have a law now that says you're the exception of protection of life or something like that? In some places in communication statutes, there's something to do, and there's one exception made, and first is there's a threat to the immediacy of life or something like that.
Most of the statutes that we've had related to telegraph messages, interestingly enough, rather than telephonic messages.
You know what I'm talking about, Donald?
Well, I'm trying to find what you're suggesting. I'm not personally familiar with it.
There is also section of law or telephonic
messages. I'm not sure if I'm
Now, in the New York one, it said, except that the provisions of this subdivision, which is saying this, do not apply to such persons when he acts pursuant to section 250.35, whatever that is.
Yes, they have a statute. New York has a statute to the point. Called failing to report criminal communications. So there's a duty of the telephone and telegraph corporation and of any employee, officer, representative thereof having knowledge that the facilities of such corporation are being used to conduct any criminal business, traffic, or transaction, to furnish or attempt to furnish to an appropriate law enforcement officer or agency all pertinent information within his possession relating to such matters and to cooperate fully with any law enforcement officer or agency investigating such matters. And he commits a crime if he fails to report criminal communication.
Yeah, that bookmaking statute.
And yet this one would make it a crime to report it.
No, that's
important. The use of the facility. That's the phone company supposed to report the setting up of the boiler room for the bookmaker, not the individual conversation between the bookmaker and the customer. This is
right.
They say any criminal transaction, so any conspiracy, I suppose, that was transacted over the phone with the customer.
They had no
any illegal agreement.
I think this should be an exception to this.
Well, we could, if we wanted to be that prosecution ready, then we could adopt that thing as number 4, and on number 3 put accepting as provided in number 4.
Put a duty on these people to report.
I'm not saying I'm for that necessarily. I'm thinking that that's one way to do it.
Sounds good. Well, the other thing I'm trying on emergency telephone
calls. I don't want to get
behind the end of that phone.
Maybe there's some case law or something, that somewhere or other there is something that exempts what is immediate.
Let's give this a little further thought before we act upon it.
Yeah.
And Don, you and Roger, see what you can find, see what ideas you can come up with, because what Don points out, I think, could be a serious thing. Well, our next meeting will be January 22nd. 23rd and 24th. Along the line, a la Chandler, I'd like to compliment and thank the commission for your attendance. Subcommittee meetings and the commission meetings, and for all the hard work that you're actually devoting toward this very worthy cause. I think it's probably the hardest working commission. In fact, one of our members told me only the other night, this guy who turned is killing us.
The room are turned. The word is killing us.
That was the way it all was.
No, it was Wallace Carson.
These two guys that I hear both in, they can't be here on the 23rd and 24th.
I'll be here on the 23rd, but I can't be here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've got a problem on the 24th for a couple hours. Since the governor appointed the chairman of the Judicial Fitness Commission, the Supreme Court, he can no longer serve, and I'm vice chairman. And the commission's having one of its meetings. It has some important matters coming to court the 24th. We've tried to arrange trying to make arrangements to meet in room 319 in the state office building in Portland, and I'd have to be gone for 2 or 3 hours, but other than that, I could be.
When would you meet? Would you start?
Saturday morning.
Don, could you get by me in the afternoon?
It's not very well, huh?
Not too well.
Are we going to have subcommittee one the night before?
We had thought that possibly, or I had thought, Bruce, that possibly if we were going to have a 2-day commission meeting, maybe we could have subcommittee one meet Friday night after dinner, because I thought then that we only had about an hour.
One of those happy hours, Friday.
To go, and maybe that would be better.
Yeah.
If that would be okay with you and Tom.
Wally, are those 2 dates okay with you? Tom, either you or Lee?
I'm sure.
Don? Ken?
I think I have a leave remaining for the 23rd.
Well, you'll be coming back to the court. Tom?
Okay.
Mr. Frost?
Hello.
Frank?
I've
got to
be another meeting.
The 24th. Well, we'll still have a forum. Is it all right? Leave it that way.
Yeah.
We'll meet subcommittee number one Friday night, and that way we'll come down Friday morning and stay here on Friday night. Is that all right?
Is that better? We're going to have our meeting on Friday.
Yeah. Yes.
A 1-day meeting.
No, a 2-day.
No, it'll be 2 days.
Friday and Saturday.
And that will practically finish us up.
I have a steam over to that night, so if you want to put members in all the time.
Oh, I don't know whether I want you voting on that trip.
We can do this. Now, if the members would be agreeable, particularly the subcommittees 2 and 3, to trying to put another subcommittee in there sometime before the week. Because we made a little bit of progress this weekend, and I anticipated that we do have now, what we have to go to subcommittee yet, new work, we've got an article on gambling, an article on firearms, and then we have just a minor article which is really going to be kept open to pick up miscellaneous offenses that don't fit anyplace else that we still want to retain.
Who's got firearms?
Hasn't gone yet.
It's going to go to number 3.
Now, what about the narcotics? Who has that? You have that, Wally?
No, number 3 has narcotics.
Well, all we have is narcotics, firearms, and gambling. And
miscellaneous.
Narcotics has been through the subcommittee.
Right. You had came back?
Yeah, we just got the minutes.
Yeah, it was sent back by the commission, and we've taken it back through.
So we can completed.
No, wait a minute, man, Peter, he's ready to go back to subcommittee. Yeah, right.
Had a meeting and then they were
getting the grain subcommittee together, and that would be June, and that would be in February.
Let's have a one-day meeting then, Don.
Okay, and I'll get with the subcommittee chairman to see what he's having.
All right, well, then in that event, let's have subcommittee number one meet Thursday night.
Okay.
Okay.
Then we have the one-day meeting on Friday, Saturday.
Friday.
Friday.
Okay.
I gotta go check out. Tom?
Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
Yeah.
You heard it. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Carry. No vote. Criminal homicide. George, that's yours, isn't it?
It is, Senator.
All right. Welcome back, George.
Yes. We know it's taken 4 months to get over that last meeting on insanity.
Fighting through.
Still a little tender about that. That's what Chandler started to do this morning already. It's always a sobering experience. One of my responsibilities is to teach legal writing at the university. First year, of course. Yesterday, one of my first-year legal writing students came in to see me and said, there's a notice on the board about a class assignment. I don't understand it. It's always good for me to get that once in a while. Yeah. I realize I'm not perfect, so I do realize I'm not perfect. Yeah.
Did that Bob?
Yeah. Remember it.
I told the student I'd be happy to clarify it. Naturally, the student would get a failing grade in the course.
Poor guy.
I already lost, glad it changed a bit.
The new era hasn't really done anything on it.
Orlando Plow continues.
We begin with the preliminary section one, which stakes out the language that we're going to use. The new look in criminal homicide. And
is this draft number two?
Beg pardon?
Number two.
Yes.
All right. Reflects some changes that were made in the subcommittee. The criminal homicide is now broken into three branches. Murder, manslaughter, and negligent homicide. Those are different terms in offense because they encompass what heretofore has been involuntary and voluntary manslaughter and murder in several degrees, two degrees, and a crime called negligent homicide for automobile cases, but we'll see how that fits in later on. The term criminal is used, Bob, for a specific purpose because homicide may occur which is not criminal and that it may be justified or excusable. And in fact, we note that it is homicide, criminal homicide, when committed without justification or excuse, which means where there perhaps is no justification or responsibility under the insanity article we're referring to, for instance, or where the act may be in self-defense or justification of that sort. Now, the article will not encompass abortion. The model penal code does not encompass abortion. In the homicide, criminal homicide, it treats it as a homicide, certainly, but with a lesser penalty. And I don't know what the commission choice will be with respect to that, but it is treated separately in the present existing Oregon statutes as a kind of manslaughter, but not murder, certainly. The way we arrive at excluding abortion is the definition of human being. It means a person who was born, who has been born and was alive at the time of the criminal act. Any questions on section one? If not, I proceed to the innards of the thing, beginning of section two.
George, I think that sub one doesn't really define the crime. Sub one is simply a general reference.
Staking out the terms that we're going to employ. Now, there are. Shall I proceed? proceed, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, all right.
Section 2 makes, I think, two major changes in the law of murder as compared to existing law. First, and most noticeable, dispenses or does away with degrees of murder. The comment following the article explains the reason for this in terms of the historical, the beginnings of degrees. They stem from the capital punishment aspect, largely of murder. And it was a way of allowing juries to impose a lesser penalty than capital punishment. That was one of the branches for the degree system. But more important, I think, for turning away from the degree in murder is the almost metaphysical meaning that the differences between first and second degree has come to be. For instance, first degree murder usually is determined from second degree by the element of premeditation. And yet the cases throughout the country, and two or three in Oregon, show that even an instant time will suffice for premeditation. So that actually you can't distinguish, and it's almost impossible for a judge or a court to instruct a jury with respect to such a minimal amount of time. And this has caused great difficulty in the cases on this score. Secondly, degree murder really imposes some listings which don't necessarily reflect the dangerousness of the person before the court. A comparison I use, for instance, is a husband who lies in wait for his wife's paramour on a dark and stormy night and kills him, clearly premeditated murder, assuming away now the emotional distress factor or provocation, which might reduce it to manslaughter, but at any rate, kills, and this constitutes first-degree murder, clearly premeditated and deliberate. And if the person who fires a gun into the police station or into a house full of people and kills, has committed a kind of reckless homicide with a depraved heart, that's generally determined to be second-degree murder. And I submit that it's between the two, the second is far more dangerous than the first. The first is very unlikely to ever kill again, but the second might very well, because he cares not at all about the safety of others. The dispensing with the degree will mean that the court will have both before it and have the opportunity to examine each individual and determine the sentence and penalty best suited to that individual. You can see, of course, if the degree system still worked, there would be limitations with respect to the way they'd be treated. As a matter of fact, the husband who kills would get a life sentence automatically in the present law, and the man guilty of second-degree murder could receive no more than an actual 25 years. Now, in a sense, it was pointed out in the subcommittee, this allows us to impose a greater penalty in certain what had been second-degree murder cases. Well, that's possible, but I submit that it's desirable because the court, through its sentencing procedures, is better able to respond, I think, to the individual, the characteristic of the individual, how dangerous he is to society, and deal better with him in these cases. Now, the second major change, I think, relates to the felony murder doctrine. For the first time, a very limited offense is available to a defendant who heretofore probably would be absolutely liable for a death arising out of the commission of one of the violent felonies. We list here the felonies most often said to be those which are violent in nature and from which death may quite easily and naturally occur during the commission of this crime, burglary, kidnapping, rape, forced sodomy, three or four others listed there. Presently, we have a system of absolute liability. If death results during the commission of one of the felonies, then the actor or co-felon who doesn't even fire the shot or use the lethal weapon is usually guilty, and in fact, it's been extended so far in some jurisdictions as to be extremely doubtful as to the applicability, and here I'm referring to the situation where one of the co-felons himself is killed by a victim, or an innocent bystander is killed by a policeman during the exchange of gunfire. Now, I'm not certainly, I'm not trying to argue that this is not a deplorable criminal kind of act, but the person who is involved as a co-felon here may, if he may show, if he can show certain specific things on behalf of himself, he is entitled then to an acquittal on murder, but not the underlying felony, of course. And they're listed in subsection 2 in the section. You'll notice that it's quite a limited defense, and it is on the burden is on the defendant in this case to come forward and to carry his defense by preponderance of the evidence. This is a change from the Model Penal Code, which I believe is more liberal in this view. The Model Penal Code simply says that when one kills with the extreme indifference to human life, that's murder. And then it goes on to say that there's a presumption that this has occurred, that murder has occurred, if the killing occurs during the felonies listed, which are approximately the same. In that case, the defendant may overcome this presumption. Obviously, this allows him to rebut the presumption that he is guilty of felony murder without the specific listings that we have here, which come from the Nuremberg statute. So I would say it's in the middle ground with respect to the newness of this idea, but most modern codes have interjected some kind of a defense here to cut down what has become a runaway crime that is felony murder. The third section deals with aiding, causing or aiding suicide, and I do not believe this changes the law in Oregon. It puts it in a different context. One who causes or aids another to commit suicide is guilty of manslaughter, but one who, through duress or deception, causes another to kill himself, or he says, all right, let's kill each other, I'll kill you, and then, or you kill yourself, and I'll kill myself, makes a pact, and deceives another into killing himself, this is murder. Otherwise, manslaughter, or perhaps, I suppose, the husband who watches his wife painfully dying before his eyes and becomes emotionally disturbed, and I'm using this term again in the phrase that it's used as a way of reducing murder to manslaughter, may have the crime lesser than murder. That, I do not believe, makes a change in the Oregon law. I think it summarizes Section 2, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman, I have two or three questions. You say that I didn't understand his last explanation about causing suicide.
You want that? Well, if the person who is committing suicide, who actually performs the act that results in death, says, "Please get put the poison on the table," and the person puts the poison on the table, aiding or causing another to commit suicide, you are guilty of manslaughter.
But not murder?
No. Unless it's by deception. Where you say, here, take this sleeping pill. It'll get you out of your pain, or the suicide pack, I think, would probably be a better demonstration.
I also have a question on 1 sub C, the various categories of felonies involved in felony murder. It's not my recollection that we define the crime of sodomy in the first degree. Do we?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
Oh, excuse me. Then in 2, where you say it is an affirmative defense, have we throughout made it clear that when we say affirmative defense, that means the burden is on the defendant? By preponderance? Do we have a general
definition? My knowledge, that's going to be a general definition.
Yes, we've had a...
I thought we'd gone back and forth on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, we have, but we have a policy decision on that that we are going to define. Those have not yet been placed in the code, but affirmative defense will be defined as the burden on the defendant to come forward and...
And to persuade.
And the burden of proof by preponderance.
I make it clear in the comment that that's what's intended.
Yeah,
and Don and I understand what the we've had this problem with respect to other defenses and other articles too.
And then my question on 2 sub B, where you say did not commit and so forth, did not aid in the commission thereof. Now, I take it that means that the for one seeking to assert the defense. Though he aided in the principal crime, he didn't aid in the act which caused the death of the deceased. Now, but is that, how would this fit in with the general law of principal and accomplice? Is it in effect simply carving sort of an exception out, or what? In other words,
My immediate reaction is no, it's not carving an exception, because in the law of complicity, there must be a purpose to commit the substantive crime, that is, the crime for which one is held as an accomplice. Now, there's absolutely no purpose to commit murder arising out of felony murder. This is one of the problems with the doctrine. The purpose was to rob the bank. And through long history, as you are well aware, we have inferred, or we have transferred intent to, in a mythical sense, shifted the mens rea of bank robbery to the mens rea of murder. This has caused one of the problems.
Well, it's my recollection that we have an instruction that, which is in the, it's in the instruction dealing with parties to crimes and aiding and abetting, and it says something to the effect that the aider and abetter is responsible for commission of a crime by another or any other criminal act committed pursuant to the criminal design or something to that effect. Now, I take it this would be a departure from that.
Yes, because, I suppose, because again, this would not be part of the criminal design. And they didn't set out to murder. In fact, that's the basis of this whole defense here. I didn't think any of my cohorts were armed with a deadly or dangerous weapon. We made no plans whatsoever. I had no reasonable belief that anybody would use violence, and all the way through, that it's contrary to any design to kill. And he's got to convince the jury of that, and I don't have any doubt that the jury is going to be extremely difficult to convince.
Back to your bank robbery situation, I mean, they don't carry out the whole left bank without weapon, that is, if somebody gets killed.
It's done with the note without the gun. Passing the note through, I've got a gun in this bag. And I think it happens often enough to make it a practical consideration. The toy pistol is used.
This would, the felony murder section would actually include one or two felonies which are not now in the first degree felony murder.
Not now in the first degree.
Second degree felony murder doctrine is abolished entirely. In Oregon now, as Judge Burns points out,
is it rape, robbery, arson, and burglary is first degree felony murder now?
I think it's
rape, robbery, arson.
And then any other felony is second degree.
Yeah, right.
Is it escape the first degree?
That check.
Escape isn't listed in the
house. Well,
there are only four. I don't have my
to make it first degree murder,
but I believe the first is correct.
No, but I remember. I thought that
second degree felony murder means all other felonies, death arising out of any other felony not listed under first degree felony murder. That doctrine is now abolished.
First is now rape, arson, robbery, burglary.
In any degree. Yeah.
There's a good reason, I think, for that. The felony murder doctrine is pretty rare, really. The number of deaths arising out of serious or violent kind of crimes is small in comparison to the number of crimes committed in the category. And studies I've seen show this. It's a real aberration on the criminal scheme. This is, I'm talking about the first degree type. And in the second degree, where we get down into the kind of felonies that are doubtful anyhow as to whether or not they're really the violent kind of felonies that should be treated in the same category. So that the focus, I think, of this code, certainly, and this draft, is upon the character, the nature of the act, not the particular way it's defined, not the criminal definition of the act, but the nature of the act. Was it purposeful or knowing? The death resulted from it. If so, it's murder. Was it reckless with extreme disregard for human life? If so, it's murder. Or was it merely a reckless act, as defined within our general definitions of recklessness? And if so, it's manslaughter. Or if it's less than recklessness, that is criminal negligence, then it constitutes the crime of negligent homicide, which is a lesser felony in the scale, presumably the third one down on whatever our grading scale turns out to be.
And I take it that our section, which I don't know whether we got to yet or not, the one which purports to limit the prosecutions arising out of a single transaction, that section would not prevent the trial, let's say, of a fellow on robbery merely because he wiggled off the hook on felony murder.
No, no. This defense goes only to the homicide arising from the underlying felony.
Mr. Chairman, Bob, I understood what affirmative defense was until last night when the three lawyers on subcommittee number one began to argue about what it was. I'm now lost again. I understand that it has to be raised by the defendant, and it's up to him to prove it by preponderance of the evidence. But I'm not sure at what point in the proceeding it has to be raised, whether notice has to be given to the prosecution, as it is in insanity business, or whether it can be just raised at some point during the proceeding when the defendant takes a stand and says,
I'm sorry if I screwed you up, because I don't understand today either, or last night.
Well, I wasn't there last night, but I can give you the benefit of my views, Bob.
Well, that's good. This will be different than non-views, I suppose.
No notice of this kind of defense is required. When the indictment is filed, all the defendant has to do is come in at the right time and say not guilty.
Yeah.
It's not like responsibility, where he has to say not guilty, and then I'm going to file a notice here that I'm going to defend on the grounds that I'm insane or irresponsible. The state has no notice of it informally, but I would be much surprised that a prosecutor wouldn't be aware that it was coming up, because usually prosecutors have done a pretty thorough job and can pretty well see into what the defendant's line is going to be. But at any rate, the defendant puts this on in order of when his turn comes at the trial, his case in chief. Is that correct, Bruce?
Well, he already can start putting it on in cross-examination.
Well, sure, even on board.
We're here.
Let's be honest.
Yeah, at any time of the dog.
As long as the jury's in the box.
Well, it seems.
And that used to be in the way we would do insanity defense before that particular statute requiring notice.
So the alibi requires notice in a lot of states. It does not require, no notice is required in Oregon.
Yes, it was passed. Well, now.
We were getting at the basis of discussion in our subcommittee. Three or four times this matter has come up before us. We have tended to write out the word affirmative, haven't we?
Yeah.
Well, it just depends on the approach that we took. Now, we have taken out the word affirmative if we felt that it would just be a question of imposing upon this defendant to inject the issue of this defense. In other words, he has to raise the defense, but the burden does not shift to the defendant. In other words, once this, if it's just a straight defense, and most of our defenses have, well, I wouldn't say most, but we've had some of each, but when we've characterized a defense as a straight defense, we have kept in mind that the burden does not shift. In other words, the burden would stay on the state to disprove that defense beyond a reasonable doubt. Whereas on an affirmative defense, such as insanity, some of these other places where we characterize as affirmative, the burden of proof does shift to the defendant. And he has to establish that defense by a preponderance of the evidence.
But unlike the insanity business in this case, why he's not required to give notice at the time of pleading or at some time early in the proceedings.
That's right. The mere fact that we characterize it as an affirmative defense does not require him to give notice or plead it.
The reason, Bob, is in that particular case is because you know you're going to have to bring expert witnesses in, and it takes a long time sometimes for the state to get ready, and it would interrupt the trial. You're asked to stop at that point, or it would be an injustice not to stop at that point. Here, the same witnesses probably are going to be involved that would be involved throughout the trial, so there isn't that. This is about to say that it doesn't cause the state a lot more trouble. It certainly does.
Let me try to get clarified on this, because I was dead wrong last night and fouled everybody up. But on page 28 of Offenses Against Privacy of Communications, which is in our book here, we provide that it is a defense to prosecution under this article that the person charged was an employee of a communications common carrier. All right. Now, that means that if the burden is upon the state in the presentation of its case in chief to prove that this defendant
that he was fired
did all these things, and also was not an employee of a communication common carrier. Is that right, Don?
Well, if the defense has been raised, it could be that at the time of the case in chief that they're not aware, the state wouldn't be aware of this defense.
Then it would be upon
unless it might be brought out in cross-examination of a prosecution witness or something like that.
Then it's upon the state in rebuttal.
They might have to, that might be the first opportunity they'd have to...
I guess the question...
It's the way with self-defense. It's the same way. It comes up and the defendant has to raise it, but the state's still got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
But the state doesn't have to allege in its indictment or its information that the person was not...
No.
All right.
And this is one of the reasons where we've taken some of these situations that are now characterized in statute as an exception and made them a defense, because it has removed this burden of proving it or alleging it in your complaint or indictment.
Negativing
the exception in your complaint. So we've tried to simplify that from the process of the state's pleading and require it to be a defense. In other words, you don't have to plead it or establish it in your case in chief.
And you wouldn't have to call the manager of the Bell telephone company until the defendant raised the issue that he was an employee, and then you turn around and call.
Well, does the defendant raise the issue merely by saying so in his opening statement, for instance, or must he produce evidence?
Yeah, there would have to be some evidence. That opening statement.
That depends on the law as developed in
some
the state.
Some attorneys are pretty good testifiers. That doesn't constitute evidence.
Your case law now, your case law on self-defense, for example. There's a case, and I can't recall the citation, although I cited it in my commentary on justification, and that is that if there's any evidence, even if the defendant hasn't raised it, if there any evidence has come in during the trial which would create a question of self-defense, and he's entitled to an instruction on self-defense. So,
what constitutes any evidence is a matter for the court, and this is one of the areas of flexibility, and varies from state to state. Some courts will require more than others. But that is case law, not, I think, and rightly so, it can't be defined by legislation.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think we can establish by statute how these defenses are going to be raised, because I think they could be raised.
Bob, the really interesting thing about this is why we have the affirmative defense. One of the reasons, and I suppose the principal reason, is because it's such a peculiar situation that it's within the knowledge of the defendant almost exclusively, and it's certainly in this kind of a situation it would be, and it would be unfair to the state to have to put on the kind of evidence that it just simply doesn't have and can't get, because the defendant personally is so deeply involved. And that was the reason why the commission felt that the affirmative defense ought to be applied to responsibility. That is, the defendant must introduce the issue and must prove it by a preponderance. And I'm going to say that I still haven't given up. I differ from the commission on that particular policy. I don't think that it ought to be a burden on the defendant with respect to the proof. I just got a copy of a brief in the case of State versus Earp. I don't know whether it's Earp versus Cuffman or whatever it is. But it's from one of our graduates of about 4 years ago. And they're in the federal courts now in habeas corpus where he's lost, but he's litigating the issue of burden of proof and insanity, and he says we're going to the United States Supreme Court again on this issue.
Is this the body in the Trump case?
No. Well, the murder was in Portland, and they arrested the guy over in Pendleton and brought him back by car.
Yeah.
But I'm very hopeful that the commission will have to reverse itself on that. But we won't know for a long time, I'm sure. But those are the basic policies. Choice.
Any further questions? Further discussion? This does constitute quite a change, though, but in each of these instances where it's a defense, it's adequately clear in here, you think that it's only a defense to murder?
Yes, that's correct. Are you talking about the felony murder situation now?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure.
Well, that. Sorry, you're violating the fee of subsection 1.
Page 5.
Well, and then on 6 also, which is sub 3, I think the last sentence there. As far as that particular defense.
That's
on
this two.
Oh, I see. Now, I see.
That wasn't in the model penal code, and I thought it was necessary to make clear that that it was a reduced murder only. It wasn't a defense to manslaughter.
And I think George mentioned this, but under 2, I think that
yeah.
we should be clear on this, that these are conjunctive requirements that,
yes. every
that
one
he
of
has to establish yeah. every one of these things in order to maintain the...
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I think this is a significant departure, and I'm certainly not opposed to it, but George, tell us a little bit about what your research has indicated insofar as the reception that this change has met in the states which have abolished the first and second degree distinctions for murder and have gone this route. I noticed that you indicated in your commentary that some states have. Has this met with a pretty good reception?
It has, John. I don't have to refer to the new codes because several states have never had degrees of murder. Some states have always had just one degree. And in those states, they have far less difficulty in the instructions and treatment of a particular individual for sentencing. And this traditionally has been less troubled in states with one degree. Now, I must confess that I haven't looked at the cases, if there are any yet, under these newer codes, but I would predict that the result would be the same as under the established law in those states that have always traditionally had just one degree. It is preferable. System as far as flexibility in sentencing goes and ease with which a jury can get the concept and deal with the concept of whether this is murder or not.
Now, and you contemplate that murder would be a punishable by up to life imprisonment and then leave the sentencing prerogative to the judge.
I believe the present model penal code provision is life at the extreme for first degree felony. Isn't that correct, Don? Mm-hmm. I don't know what the decision would be of the sentencing here in this thing, but that's right. It's within the existing first degree felony penalty for murder.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the model penal code does have the option in there for those states, and as much as the ALI didn't take a position on capital punishment, they do have the option in there for the states that still retain capital punishment. That can be included in your maximum.
I think this is a substantial improvement, particularly with the elimination of that premeditation factor that you have so many problems about.
It'll eliminate a lot of the basis for victory in the DA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it
moved the South.
Yeah. Well, I think that probably a lot of it. First degree. Yeah, you don't really have too much to deal with on this either.
Yeah.
Well, I think, and by way of disclosure, I think that Michigan, I believe, has 2 degrees and retained 2 degrees. And Don tells me from his conversations last summer at that meeting about codification back at Michigan that they did that specifically for plea bargaining purposes. Some states, obviously, are still concerned about Troy Horsgate on murder. I personally think that it ought not to be a consideration.
Well, under this, the jury can take care of it.
Still, there's no reason why the state can't do that, or for negligent homicide. There's still plenty of negotiation room.
I think so, too. I didn't think of anything.
negotiate with the judge.
I thought it was a consideration, but it's a fact that it does take away that area of dealing.
Well, I move we approve it, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a substantial step. In the right direction.
You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion?
I'll second the motion.
Clerk will. Norbert, you call the roll.
Cinderburn?
Aye.
Parson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Beardsley?
Aye.
Johnson?
I think it's a bit.
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Spalding?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
That's too easy, George.
Section. John, you are letting him get by pretty easily.
Well, we just thought we'd, you know, kind of have a lull before this storm.
Well, there's a couple of sections to go.
Yeah. Section 3.
I haven't forgotten that session on arson, George.
There's a special note with respect to this section that the commission ought to be aware of at the outset. The subcommittee had a considerable difficulty and some doubts, considerable doubt, with respect to the formulation in subsection 2. And subsection 2 is the new look to what used to be provocation, which reduced murder to manslaughter. That is, where one acted from the heat of passion, which was irresistible to him, and killed deliberately, voluntary, killing that this reduced murder and manslaughter, he could prove it. But I'll come to that in just a moment. First, manslaughter makes this definition makes some major changes in addition to the one that I've just indicated partially. The first, the biggest change, I suppose, is that this definition entirely abolishes the misdemeanor manslaughter rule, which is the equivalent of felony murder. Misdemeanor manslaughter is where you hit somebody in a fracas, and then somebody trips over a chair and hits his head on the iron rung of the fireplace and fractures his skull and dies as a result. And case law, as strictly applied, says that there was a misdemeanor, there was a wrongful act, that is the striking in the first place, and that death followed as a causation, a chain of causation, which is undeniable. But death followed from that, therefore, this is a misdemeanor manslaughter, death as a result of a wrongful act. It was criminal homicide. Now I'm not suggesting that there may not yet be criminal homicide involved in this particular action, but the focus now is not on the underlying wrongful act, but what kind of an act it was. And we define manslaughter then in terms of recklessness. Recklessness is defined elsewhere in the code, similarly as it is in the Model Penal Code, in shorthand phrase is a conscious disregard of a known risk. Substantially, probably resulting in the harm hoped to be avoided, and one that would not be taken by a law-abiding citizen. I can't remember the exact language, but it is a fairly good definition of the culpability here, which you have dealt with elsewhere in the opening articles of the code. All right, so one would ask, not that the was it a misdemeanor when you struck someone, and clearly it is assault and battery, but was it the reckless kind of act from which one would consciously be aware that you're running the risk that person might be killed as a result? Well, an example I give in the comment to demonstrate this, and one which comes from an actual case, so it isn't one of these professorial pipe dreams, where a person shoved another in a scuffle through a screen door, and on the way through the screen door, the person falling through the door cut his thumb and died subsequently from tetanus, from the rusty screen. The case held manslaughter because of the wrongful act, that is the pushing the assault and battery through the screen. Well, this is submitted to be a pretty ridiculous result in terms of culpability with respect to the homicide flowed from it. If that case arose under this formulation, and the jury follows the instruction as to what recklessness is, there could not be a conviction for manslaughter, because a reasonable man wouldn't expect someone to die in that fashion because he shoved someone who happened to go through a screen door. It might, however, fall under negligent homicide under the next formulation in section 4, but that would be for the jury to determine then whether the act was of the negligent kind, that is an inadvertent risk-taking that death might result from the original shoving. And probably it wouldn't be homicide at all in the facts that I've posed. But it is a turn away from the old inflexible, insensitive kind of test known as misdemeanor manslaughter or the wrongful act doctrine. The other part of manslaughter as presently defined in ORS relates to death resulting from a lawful act done without due caution and circumspection. And this doctrine is not applied here, obviously, in the formulation, because it's felt that although that particular formulation presently in Oregon is a little more receptive to the actual mens rea involved, because it does look at the caution and circumspection of the actor, the courts, as I view the cases, take a view that mere civil negligence will suffice with respect to what is caution. And I think we can all agree that civil negligence has no place in the criminal law. This formulation, again, focuses on the recklessness of the act, as determined generally by the definition. Now, the second subsection is the one that got particular attention by the subcommittee. And I think I ought to read it. Homicide, this is the equivalent of the old provocation doctrine, but it's with a new look and much more subjectively phrased than the old objectivity of provocation. Homicide, which otherwise would be murder. Criminal homicide constitutes manslaughter when a homicide would otherwise be murder is committed under the influence of extreme mental or emotional disturbance for which there is a reasonable explanation or excuse. That reasonableness of the explanation is determined from the standpoint of the person acting who actually causes the death in the situation and under the circumstances as he believes them to be. Now you can see there's an interesting admixture of subjectivity as well as objectivity in this defense. What the Model Penal Code, what New York, Michigan, and I believe Illinois and California, all the new codes are trying to get away from is the inflexible old common law doctrine of provocation. And under that, about the only thing that would ever get to the jury would be whether the person catches the paramour in bed with his wife, or whether one is perhaps being assaulted in a violent manner and injured and strikes out. The most obvious and very limited kinds of situations that were held to be provocation, which would result in reducing the crime from murder to manslaughter. Now, we're not saying this excuses somebody because he catches his wife in bed with someone else and kills that someone else. We're simply saying it reduces them from murder to manslaughter. But that system was pretty insensitive to these kinds of situations. For instance, an unexpected reaction to a drug where one is given by a doctor, which may, for some reason, cause extreme irritability in a person. It causes him for no apparent reason to a reasonable man to strike out and kill when insulted as a possibility. Or where one is blind, or where one is humpbacked, or in the famous case in England where one is impotent and kills a lady of the night who jeers at him and strikes him and so forth. And he reacts from this emotional disturbance and kills her. Now, obvious difficulties with this, raised in the subcommittee, is that it opens up the trial to possibilities of a lot of psychiatric testimony to show that this disturbance was the kind that carried this man beyond control to the sense, in the sense that he would react in the way he did in the situation known to the actor. But again, I'd like to remind the commission, in speaking in behalf and for this proposition, that ultimately the decision is made by the jury, which is told to put yourself in that person's situation. Don't take his moral values, just take the situation as it appeared to be to him. Was he a coward? Was the man coming toward him in this situation the kind that would produce an extreme fear in this particular person to make him lash out, believing himself to be right in self-defense to kill, when in fact, under the self-defense doctrine, which is a reasonable belief of serious bodily harm, he was not justified That's a separate article on justification. But at any rate, the jury must decide whether the defense is reasonable. Now, as a stemming from the difficulties that some of the subcommittee members saw with respect to cranking in psychologists and psychiatrists, perhaps, at the trial, was a question whether notice should be required, as we require under the partial responsibility doctrine of the insanity defense. That was left open by the subcommittee because it felt that it did not want to hold this from the full commission's consideration, but without approving it, it wanted it to pass along to the commission to decide the basic policy issue. And if, in fact, the commission says, yes, this is the way we want to formulate this, then the commission may wish to discover or to discuss the question of notice in case a defendant does intend to bring in expert witnesses.
George.
How?
Isn't it rather difficult to separate the circumstances as the defendant believes them to be from his scheme of moral values?
I suppose it is. I'm not suggesting it isn't. The model penal code says of this formulation, it allows to come to mind, there are still areas of uncertainty in the formulation before us. And it said, and that's desirable, and I agree. The idea here is to make the criminal law responsive to the actual mens rea with which it's supposed to deal. That is, subjecting what the particular actor had in his mind. Now, the provocation doctrine does not approach that. It's much more objective. It imposes the feelings of other people on the actual actor.
The reasonable man.
Yeah, the reasonable man, completely without any of the physical disabilities or emotional disturbances that the actor actually felt. What this formulation does is allow the person, the defendant in this case, to go to the jury and explain fully why he acted this way, why the death resulted. You know, under the common law doctrine, I'm not sure about the rules in Oregon, but I assume they're pretty much the same, the jury would never get this kind of evidence because the court would rule it out because it would say, as a matter of law, that is improper kinds of evidence and it may not be submitted to the jury beyond one or two or three basic kinds of situations, the paramour in bed with the wife or the violent harm and so forth.
Actually, in argument, all of this goes in anyway today, doesn't it?
I suppose it does.
Yeah, but the danger is...
I suppose it does.
But the danger is in permitting all this expert testimony on it.
Well, why is that danger, John? Danger to who?
Well, I think we
jury
have to
isn't
have...
believe most of it anyhow. You know
well, in connection with that, what's the difference between a reasonable explanation and a reasonable excuse?
Or what's the difference between disturbance and illness?
Or what's extreme under the circumstances?
Well, here, this could be read to mean that a fellow had a reasonable explanation that would explain his conduct as reasonably leading to causing a death, but not necessarily properly leading. You distinguish between explanation and excuse, by the way, that's
well. In subcommittee, we in discussing this section, I brought up the my objection to it, and it seems to me that this allows the defendant a backdoor approach to diminished responsibility. It seems to me that under our responsibility article, that this kind of defendant has available to him under the diminished responsibility defense an opportunity to raise this kind of question.
But that must
under
come from mental disease or defect under Article 4, the responsibility section. This does not necessarily stem from a mental disease or defect. Emotional disturbance is not necessarily related to mental disease or defect. I think that's the difference.
Well, that's where I have difficulty trying to distinguish one from the other. I'm not sure I understand what the distinction is between an emotional disturbance and a mental defect. And I don't know whether the psychiatrist can explain that, right?
Well, one's a psychosis. The other one is a neurosis.
So now, I'm a juror, I don't understand what either one is.
Well, I suppose you're suggesting then that diminished responsibility covers the field, and we ought not, we don't need this provision.
Well, that's my feeling, yes.
Well, my feeling is that it doesn't cover the field. At least there's a great doubt that it covers the field, and we need this in addition.
A normal person always cool. That's what really.
Yeah, you could have an overreaction from a drug, a therapeutic drug, and kill as a result of a chain of circumstances.
Well, it wouldn't have to be a drug. Different people react differently toward different things. For example, I could say something to you and you'd laugh it off or you wouldn't think much about it. Someone else who is extremely sensitive, my remarks may be sufficient to provoke him to an extent that he practically loses his head.
Well, I think there's an excellent case that the Model Penal Code has in demonstration of the difference between the defenses under the old provocation theory and this one. Sawmill workers or some factory workers were kidding one of their mates who was living with a person and sharing a room with another man, and they accused the who subsequently became the defender, a defendant, of being partially drugged one night by his roommate and had homosexual activities imposed on him. And this went on and on in public for quite a while, for a week or more. And each time the defendant would walk into the bar and see his friends, they'd be snickering and making remarks, and it got worse and worse with him. The more he thought about it, the more humiliated he became, until finally he killed one of the persons that was badgering him. Now, under the old provocation theory, cooling time would probably cut him off. Too much time elapsed between the original provocation and the actual death that resulted. Under this defense, the cooling time period is not considered as such. The question is it the killing is the result from the emotional disturbance under the circumstances as viewed by the defendant in his situation? Well, and it was very real to that thought.
In that situation, you probably would have, the defense had no difficulty at all in getting a number of psychiatrists testify not only was he just emotionally disturbed, but he was not criminally responsible.
As a practical matter, doesn't this just let in stuff that gets in anyway? I mean, the jury is basically...
Yeah, it gets in anyway, but what's the judge going to instruct the jury as to its meaning differently than it would without it?
You can't.
I'm not sure a jury could understand what it means.
I'm just wondering if, when society as a whole is considered, if the thing that we must decide isn't whether or not we should have a reasonable man test, or, on the other hand, open the gate so that it permits any type of a defense, any... and you know that expert defense counsel are going to conjure up some sort of a defense in each and every case where the defendant is charged under this statute. Now, which is better for us as a whole, to confine this somewhat and allow the defense when the reaction is that which could be expected from an ordinary, reasonable, prudent person, or one who has some mental or other defects that are unknown to anyone, which could vary from individual to individual, and consequently permit thousands of defenses for a same situation where today none would exist. Dave?
In line with what you're saying, Tony, I think this recognizes what is presently a statistical fact, and that is that there is less recidivism or repeaterism from crimes of violent passion than there are from things like check writing and robbery, safeguarding, that type of thing. But if the purpose of the law is going to be to protect society, we sure can't protect them by locking up a guy who probably is never going to commit the same type of crime again. We're actually creating more of a problem for society by letting a check writer loose than we are probably by letting someone who's been involved in homicide under a heat of passion.
Well, that's
not
decision.
Sufficient to rise to a lack of culpability. From what Don said, too, I think that I can picture the situation coming up after you've had the psychiatrist make the examination. And he says, as they often do, I'm just sorry, it's not insanity. He's, I mean, what they call a sociopathic personality. Under this situation, with these stresses and these strains, he really, he hit the limit, and he struck out. But he wasn't insane. And he wasn't insane even before, and even after.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
But this defense, like, will follow in with that, probably some of the same testimony. I think it ought to be allowed.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Well, now, under the example that you gave out of the Model Penal Code situation, George, that person could have availed himself of the diminished responsibility section that we've adopted in the responsibility section, and if he were charged with murder, he could be found guilty of manslaughter.
I'm not so sure he could. There was nothing in the case to indicate that he was suffering from a mental disease or a defect.
Well,
he was reacting from extreme humiliation from the situation, and I suppose that we'd have the same, I think that we'd have, each of us have a similar, very similar reaction to that.
Well, the thing is, the point is, normal people even have got these tendencies, and you promote the right circumstances, well, they're going to blow.
The thing that concerns me about this is that I've never seen a homicide case, whether it's Hansen or Burke or the one up in the Hilton Hotel that received so much publicity where the guy was extradited back from Hawaii. I've never seen one where you, that's right, couldn't impose a subjective test and draw instructions under the statute and come back with a manslaughter conviction.
Yeah, it's a reasonable explanation.
Yeah, it's a reasonable explanation.
Brody's had a reasonable explanation. He was not insane, but he had a background that led him to where he was willing to do this and couldn't keep himself from doing it because of his background. And that reasonably explained his act.
A reasonable subjective explanation. And I think that I think we've got to go to an objective test. Well, I want to hear more about it, but it concerns me because I see every one of these cases as having a reasonable explanation.
Well, I think you're correct. I think your reaction is correct, John, that there will be a great deal more, at least official, inserting into evidence these kind of defenses. Now, it's been suggested that the practical matter, this kind of evidence gets to the jury anyhow. They hear it. But as a legal matter, the judge is not entitled under present law to instruct the jury what to do with it.
That's right.
Well, now, let's look at the analogy of what we've done with respect to responsibility. We have almost exactly the same situation in Oregon with respect to the presently the insanity defense. McNaughton, on its face, is very strict. It says nothing about control or the irresistible impulse test, and yet we know from experience and research that all that evidence gets to the jury. Irresistible impulse included, that the defendant couldn't resist, Your Honor, or gentlemen of the jury, what he did. But the instruction can't carry that to the jury. Now, what we've done is to open up the ability and the authority of the court to instruct the jury that it's proper, not only that evidence was submitted, but it's proper for you to consider in determining the issue. Highly subjective kind of testimony, clearly. But the jury, I think we can all agree, is still representing the community morals and the community ethics, and if, in fact, it just simply says this isn't the kind of person that we want to commit or have committed, this is the kind of person we want in prison, even after hearing all this, they may still react and treat him as a criminal and as if he had a responsibility. And I suggest the same answer applies here. What we're simply doing is recognizing perhaps what is now the practice of putting all this kind of evidence in anyhow, now allowing the court to intelligently sit down with the jury and say, now look, you've heard this, and it's proper for you to hear it, and these are the reasons why, and I'll instruct you on it. And then it's up to the jury to look at that particular individual and say,